All right, listen. Eric, you know you're one of my favorite guests of all time.
Thank you.
You and I share something in common, which I think is a couple things in common, but we're both very passionate about startups, and I think we both have a very basic approach to startups. Tell us, what is your approach to startups in 2016? When you think about startups at their essence, what is the right way? And obviously everybody has read The Lean Startup. Who's read this book? Raise your hand if you have. I mean, it's just amazing.
Thank you.
she's awesome. we refer to the term Lean Startup all the time. But in 2016, when you're looking at businesses, and you look at them constantly, it's kind of your job. It's very similar to mine in that way. At its essence, what are startups? What's the best way to approach them?
You know, it's funny because it's been 5 years now since the book came out, so I've gotten to see a lot in the intervening time. And what is the essence? I think fundamentally a startup is an experiment. I mean, I've been saying that over and over again for a long time. And people feel like now that's kind of like obvious or like kind of a flip comment. But like, if you take that seriously, like first of all, experiment has a very formal definition. Like it's part of the scientific method. It's not just like, oh, I walked out of my house to like see if I like stumbled across like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. That was an experiment. It's like, no, that doesn't count, right?
Right.
It's a structured way of thinking. It's like, it's a way to find out if something's right. And I've gotten to work with so many incredible entrepreneurs. And as an entrepreneur myself, what I've realized is like, it's a gift to be able to see something as an experiment. You basically say, look, I think this is going to work. I have a vision for something that is amazing. And I feel like so much of the conversation in the startup like press and just, you know, even in the ecosystem ourselves, we're always like, how do I know this is going to work? Or like, what's the proof that, and you're like, you know what? I don't know that this is going to work. What I'm asking you to bet on is not that it's definitely going to work, but that it's worth running the experiment. So it's a worthwhile experiment. So if I'm like, I want to build the Large Hadron Collider, like, I can't tell you exactly what we're going to find when we turn that thing on, because if I could, it wouldn't need it. We'd already know the answer. The point is, like, I have a very good hypothesis worth spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this. But
We have Thor's hammer.
Yeah, exactly. And like, probably we won't start a black hole and destroy the whole planet, so it's probably going to be fine.
Which would be
explanation. What a great metaphor, yeah.
But it's like, we would have found out why there's no intelligent life in the universe.
Right, yeah, eventually.
Life eventually builds one of these colliders, and it eventually destroys the planet.
On the list of solutions to Fermi's paradox, that is one of the ones that is on the list. Yeah, exactly. So, I think that's kind of, it can be a flip answer, but I think it's actually, there's a lot of wisdom in it, and we could all afford to be a little bit more scientific in our approach.
What I love about this approach, the experimental approach, is it takes away a lot of emotion and bad feelings at a startup, and it gets people, I don't know if humble is the right word, but focused on what matters.
Yeah.
Do you see that?
Very much so. I mean, people always ask me, you know, about the like decision to pivot, and they're like, you know, like that's usually where this comes up, right? So you pivot situation. First of all, for people who are not up on Lean Startup, like super theory, okay, pivot is a change in strategy without a change in vision. That's it. So the first most important thing is not like, people are just like, oh, I launched a new feature today, so it's a pivot. It's like, no, that doesn't count. It just, that's a change. You made a change. Congratulations. Like, I changed my homepage to be red. It's like, that's not a pivot. Doesn't count. And then there's some people who pivot every day, and they're like, I got a new vision today, and I got to know, you know, yesterday I was making a, you know, salad dressing, and today I'm making a floor wax and whatever, you know, that old joke. So that's not a pivot either. That's just like, you have no idea what you're doing, and you have no conviction about anything. That doesn't count. So like, pivot is like kind of a magical thing. So people are like, oh, one way of interpreting all this science and everything is, oh, we'll make doing a pivot, make it easy. It's like, no. It is never easy. You guys have been through this, right? I mean, it is incredibly gut-wrenchingly hard. It's like always going to be super emotional because you've invested your life and your energy and into this thing, and you're like, just kidding. Just like yesterday, I was saying, selling to everyone I know that I'm right. And now it's like, well, turns out I was wrong. But okay, that said, having the scientific, more dispassionate framework, what it can do, the reason it makes it less emotional, less difficult, is it just gets everybody on the same page about what's actually happening. Most startups I meet with, the reason they can't pivot is not because they can't come up with a new idea. It's because they can't even agree amongst themselves whether the current idea is working. Right? So like the guy in engineering is like, oh, it's going great. And the guy in marketing is like, we're doomed today. And like, you know, the next day it's reversed, right? Customer service says this. And people all have these different opinions and the numbers are noisy and everyone's looking at their vanity metrics. And, you know, you could always find some graph in Google Analytics that's up and to the right. Right, so you always find something that's going well. You always present to your
look
board.
Look at our bounce rate. It's up and to the right.
It's always something. My favorite graph of all time is cumulative users registered. But yeah. It can't go anywhere but up and to the right. Nobody can unregister. It's cumulative. So,
removed the delete user account feature, and now it's up
now,
to the
now
right.
Now we're up and to the right. Right? So, exactly. So, you know, just like all this nonsense. And so what makes it hard is, first of all, you can't agree about what the facts are, and so that makes it more contentious. It's like, then it becomes more like a tribal warfare between the functions or between the people who are kind of on a different side. So if we have consistent facts, if we've been using a constant dashboard this whole time, if we run rigorous experiments, then we know the truth about whether we're trending towards the outcomes that we need or not. And the second thing I think that is helpful is you say, look, and we're not giving up on the vision. And it's not that big a deal to be wrong. It happens. We're human. We make mistakes. That shouldn't actually be news to anybody. And anyone who pretends like there's this one human being that never makes a mistake, in history, that has not led to good outcomes, historically speaking. So let's not go that direction. Let's accept that we're fallible, you know?
I think one of the great things about your work and the book, and especially at this time in history, is, you know, we had this big buildup to the mythological God King, CEO, all visionaries. Steve Jobs would, I guess, be the one that comes to mind.
Of course.
Or Bill Gates, or even Elon now. And it's kind of freeing in a way that we don't have to benchmark ourselves against, you know, the sort of historical success of Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. Because, let's face it, you know, they may have been brilliant, they may have been a moment in history, but that doesn't help you. Like Theranos emulating the way Steve Jobs looks and wearing the turtleneck, it does nothing for the core features of the product.
I used to make that joke all the time that founders are putting on the black turtleneck, and I can't make the joke anymore because people think I'm digging a specific person. Like, but I was like, no, I was making that joke before. But then I'm like, Jesus, people actually do it.
Right.
And right, the problem with that strategy is twofold. First of all, the story you think you know about what Steve Jobs and Elon and Bill Gates are like is probably not true unless you're their personal friend and you knew them before they were famous. What's that you say? You didn't? So you don't know anything about what they're like in real life, okay? So there's like a PR machine designed to make these guys seem legendary and to make you like think about how great it is for Apple that people used to think the way they made products was like Steve Jobs, the one and only, like pulled the idea fully formed from his head and you couldn't possibly do that yourself. So it's like you can't compete with Apple because like you don't have the magic guy, so just give up. That's like excellent PR, okay? Outstanding competitive differential. Like, that's great. You make your competitors want to kill themselves.
Perfect.
It doesn't get any better than that. They're afraid
to get on the court.
Yeah, exactly. So then like they don't play you because then you're – so that's like, oh, okay, that's awesome. But the second thing – but even if it was true, even if you were like, no, Steve really, he has this magic, whatever you believe, even if that's true, you still have this problem of what's the evidence that what worked for him is going to work for you? Right, the industry is not the same as it was then.
No,
your financial situation is not the same. Like your friends, your networks, you didn't go to the same. It's like there's all these differences between then and now. You're in a different industry than they were, and it's just like could be that strategy and that approach was like the perfect thing for that place and that time, but it's not perfect now. And normally, I think people get kind of irrational about this. Like, oh, right, like you need to really run, if you want to make a claim that like acting a certain way is always good, like give me a data set to prove that that's always good. But like, no data set, this one guy did it, so I'm going to do it too. So like, it's like a doubly flawed attitude. And then like the other thing I find very comforting is go back and read the interviews with these guys like right as they were becoming famous. There's no interviews from when they were nobodies, but like you can get, there's the occasional gem. My personal favorite at the moment is a Mark Zuckerberg interview from Stanford. Have you seen this? He's sitting on a couch and some like bro at Stanford for some kind of like early video podcast, like interview. You seen this thing,
right?
Yeah, and like
they're broing out.
It's like, and he's trying to talk about Facebook and what it is. And like, if you really squint hard and really like just turn your brain off, and you could sort of see what he's going.
Yeah,
like
maybe
you could kind of see the visionary in there somewhere.
Right?
Like you're
kind of
like
maybe
oh,
a bank
okay,
shot. Yeah.
But like, no. He doesn't really know what's going to happen. He doesn't totally understand even what he's got. He doesn't understand what, like, he doesn't talk about Facebook the way he talks about it now. Obviously, it wasn't yet, like, he wasn't Mark Zuckerberg yet.
Right.
So what does that mean about you? Like, who are you going to be when you actually get successful? And like, what happens is, if you're fortunate enough to achieve product market fit in a business, and you and that business turns out to be one of the big world changers, right? Like, that experience itself changes you and makes you more awesome. So don't worry that you haven't done that yet. Like, you haven't had that experience yet. So it's not even a fair comparison, even if you believe the hype about these guys or whatever.
Okay, when we get back from this important partner message, I want to tell you the three things that I tested in the last year using the Lean Startup methodology and get your feedback on if I did them right when we get back awesome. On This Week in Startups. We're back here at Microsoft Reactor in San Francisco. My guest is Eric Ries, the author of The Lean Startup, and you did a phenomenal Kickstarter or Indiegogo?
It was Kickstarter. Kickstarter, that's right.
Where you raised how much for your next book?
We raised more than $500,000.
It was crazy.
The most successful publishing Kickstarter of all time. So, yeah, I guess that counts as success. Like, I felt good about it. Yeah, it was
and you're
very
working on
experience.
The book. I know that you're
yes,
very diligent working. It's not easy to write a book.
It's not. And I had a lot of it written already before the campaign because it was based on my the work I do with companies and the kind of training materials that I developed, the workshop. So I was like, oh, it's going to be no problem. So I, of course, like every idiotic Kickstarter creator in history, committed to an aggressive delivery date, which I have
Oops.
Now totally
Don't
blown.
Don't worry about it. When you put
I'm
it on,
sorry to the backers.
Everybody does 2x, 3x
everybody does
on
it.
Any Kickstarter
I thought I
project.
Had given myself plenty of buffer time, but like even I had the scope creep and all the things that happened to you. But like what's funny is people like send me these angry emails about how come they haven't
really?
Gotten the book yet. And I'm like, it's Kickstarter, man. Like
yeah.
Every Kickstarter project is late. It's impossible. That's how it
well,
goes anyway.
And you're talking about tens of thousands of people, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's always going to be one or two people who are
there
weird
always
like
is.
That. You know what I love to do with that?
Yeah.
I write a long email. I used to be, in my younger days, I used to be like, you know, F you, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
When I got one of these things, when I was like in my, you know, like 2 years ago. When I was in my 20s. But now what I do is when somebody writes to the feedback line, like all the tip lines, all the feedback things, I get.
Yep.
And my team at times has been like, yeah, you don't need to get that. We'll handle it for you. I'm like, no, I want that. And now I respond back, and it blows people's minds.
Interesting.
And you know, a lot of times they'll write something a little bit overly aggressive. They're frustrated in the moment. I paid for my subscription,
and
I
thing,
got double
yeah.
billed. And then I write back, wow, that's really, that's a total bummer. I'm going to make sure that they not only credit you, but give you 6 months free.
Uh-huh.
Hope you're having a great weekend. I'm going on a hike. Like I literally will write something personal like that, best Jason, and then they're right back and they're
tip.
Like, "Oh my god, I'm a really good, I'm a big fan, and I don't know, don't worry about it. You can double bill me." Like,
right, right. Like, sorry, I was just an asshole to you a second ago because I'm such a big fan. You're like, wait, what?
Exactly. But it's something about being human. Like I
totally. Oh, we all do that. Like you get upset about something, you overreact, and then you might even feel bad about it a minute later. But then like someone humanizes. I mean, I used
the
to,
moment.
Exactly right, and then you. I used to be the person who did customer support for early adopters in my startup's early days, and I used to like I was you know when I was younger I had the impulse to argue with people. They would write me nasty thing about our product
right.
sucks, and
you
I'd
were
be
defensive.
Like, "No, you're wrong," and I can't believe you would write that. And then, of course, that would just escalate the problem. And
yeah,
now, like,
well done.
And of course, like they collectively have a lot more free time than I do, so it's like you cannot win this fight. It's impossible. And eventually, I learned to just say, "You're right. Thank you for the feedback, and we're gonna." Take that into account in our product, whatever it is, like whatever it is you want, like we're going to take that under consideration. And what was great about it was if sometimes we would get lucky and the thing the person wanted was on our roadmap anyway. So then I said, instead of saying like, you idiot, that's on our roadmap anyway, I'm smarter than you,
right.
Like I used to do, I eventually learned to say, oh, thank you for that suggestion. That's really helpful. We're going to get to that. And then when we do come out with it later on the roadmap, that person feels like it was their idea.
Sure.
And they made it happen. And then what would happen is we'd be on the forums and someone else would write it and be like, these guys suck, whatever. And that person would be like, how dare you insult my product?
Yeah, now you got a super fan.
Right. It's a super fan. It's like, no, you don't even understand. I made this product what it is. And these guys were so dumb. They didn't even know not to add feature X. And I told them. And now you're crapping all over my product. And then it's like, great. Now you have people with infinite time fight each other.
And you step back.
It's a lot better than them fighting
but
you.
It's
so, yeah,
but it's all energy around you and your brand.
Exactly.
And that's actually, in terms of a marketing technique.
So powerful.
There's something very powerful about that. I told the team at Inside, when people reply to the email, and we put at the bottom of the email, please hit reply. Tell us mm-hmm. when we make a mistake or you think something's great or we miss something, whatever. And so 50 replies some days to every email. It's pretty amazing. And then not only do I reply, but the editor replies and the GM
so
of the
great.
Company. We might have a thread that's 6 or 7, you know, deep with the person. And the person just gave us, oh, why did you say this about Trump? You know, you guys are always so liberal. And then we have this big, long discussion about it. And then we put it in the bottom of the email and say, reader Eric wrote back and said, was this it? And then we do like a mailbag.
Yeah, that's
cool. It's created this virtuous cycle that's incredible. When we left for commercial break, I wanted to run by you some of the things I'm trying.
Oh, yeah.
And I want you to give me a grade in how we did.
All right.
All right. So we're first of all, we had inside.com. We were trying to do curated news.
Yep.
So my vision was too much news in the world.
Yep.
It's too much time to manage it. What if I had somebody smart read all the news 10 hours a day and tell you these are the 10 most important stories, and I'm going to summarize them with what we call the Joe Friday, which is just the facts, ma'am.
Yep.
And then maybe at the bottom we give you some what we call bulletproof recommendations, like the stingers at the end of the Marvel story. So we were spending $3 million a year building an app company.
Mm-hmm.
And we were getting low thousands of users. We then tested sending it the same curated news in an email to all 175,000 emails we had and said, what do you think of this? Do you like it?
Yeah.
And we just emailed them the same exact summary. And then we saw the open rate was amazing. We took the open rate and we said, we did it for like a week. We said, we're going to do this for a week. If you want to unsubscribe, click here, like at the top.
Right.
We then took the people who opened it the most and created the gold list. We told the gold list, the 10,000, top 10,000, we were going to keep doing this for them. And what do they think of it? And the open rate hit 50%.
That's incredible.
Then we got rid of all the developers and we just kept two people at the company and took the cost. Don't worry, I personally got them all jobs and they all got great severance. The cost of the company went from $3 million a year to run to $250. Literally one-tenth.
Yep.
The number of people using the product, because we decided to send the email twice a day,
yep.
And I'll get into that because that's the next piece. The open rate then, the size of the list went 2.5. The open rate stayed about the same, 40X%.
Yep.
And now we have 10 times as many people using it at one-tenth of the price.
Right. So it's like 100X improvement in efficiency.
But we're not making a sexy app. We can't get featured by Apple. We don't have an Apple Watch thing. But we have 100X.
That's not cool anymore. It just has to be a drone with Bitcoin and a bot if you want to be cool.
I've got to tell you something, though. Psychologically,
it was hard.
When you think about a pivot, it's so hard to give up on a year and a half of writing code in an app, to throw it away and say, news apps don't work. It was one of the hardest things I've done in my career. But,
And to lay people off, too, at the same time. That's excruciating. No, that's a good one.
And you know what happened? The people who were laying off, they were like, I think this is the right move, Jason.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you doing this. And then I told them, like, if you want to vest your equity, I'll let you vest your equity for an extra benefit of your time, whatever, for those people.
Yeah.
It worked.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, so that's a great example, because most entrepreneurs, they're looking for the quick hit. They're like, help me make my thing 10% more efficient. And generally speaking, if you're asking for a 10% efficiency boost, like, there's a problem. Because if you were already post product market fit, you wouldn't have time to be worrying about this kind of stuff. You certainly wouldn't have time to be like asking me about it. But you know what we need to be looking for are the like really dramatically different changes that can allow us to get these really like crazy improvements in efficiency. But the problem is if you promise people 100X, it sounds too good to be true. So then you come across as kind of like telemarketer. So this is great because here's an actual example.
Yeah.
This is in fact you're. Like most people just don't believe that you can work smarter, not harder. And they're like, I just need to work more hours. And it's like, look, working 40, you know, working 26 hours a day is not going to get you 100X improvement. What is like getting enough sleep, like taking a nap, whatever, doing whatever you have to do to get your brain actually working, taking a step back and saying, what is the evidence we have here that our current setup, like, are we getting our $3 million worth out of the results that we're getting?
And like, yeah.
So kudos to you for having the courage and then the honesty to just say, let's do it. And then to make it right for the people who are affected. I think that's really the formula.
Okay. So now here's the second debate we had and how we answered it with the Lean Startup methodology.
Yep.
And everybody who comes works for me, I get them the book. I just tell them, buy it, read it. Literally, I tell them that. I think anybody who's listening to the podcast or here live on the live stream, just buy the book and literally keep 10 copies on your shelf to give to people as they come work for you, because they will get so much out of it.
Oh, thank you.
And, well, then you start talking about the same language.
And that is an underrated benefit, I think, of having a shared vocabulary for these things.
For sure. Because once, when you start telling people to do an experiment, they're like, well, I know the result of the experiment. I don't need to do it.
Right.
And that's always frustrating. How do you handle that?
oh, someone thinks they already know.
That, yeah, they're like, well, I know that already. Or we know that already because this product does that. Or I saw this in my last company. How do you deal with that?
My favorite is, I'm sure you're right. So let's double check.
Oh, love
it. What could it hurt, right? Like, yeah. Since you're so right.
Easy peasy.
This is going to be great. You're going to be lording this over me forever. Surely, since you're so confident, you're going to win. We're all looking forward to that. And then you find out whether people, you find out what the confidence level really is. Because, of course, then most people are like, oh, no, but I have a reason why, you know, it's not going to, it's not a valid experiment. It's like, but a second ago, you told me it was a valid experiment, but you knew the answer. Now you're saying it's not a valid experiment. Which is it? And then it's like, okay, well, actually, it probably would have been valid, but it's too small a sample size. Right? And then you're like, okay, great. So let's, but like, probably, since your thing is such a good idea, it's not going to be buried in the signal-to-noise ratio, right? Like, this is not a presidential poll. We're trying to figure out what 10% here, to a tenth of a percent here or there. Like, your idea is so good, right? You just said this is going to, like, 10x our whole business, right? So the signal should be really clear even with my small sample. And then you've really painted the person into a corner because their bravado is now the reason not to do the experiment. And then you usually, like, three excuses in, you actually find out that there's some, they have, in fact, an anxiety about whether this is going to work or not. And they were worried the experiment might reveal that. That's really why people don't want to do it.
And that gets back to ego.
It's all about that, yeah.
Which is really what you have to release yourself from, I think, to be a great entrepreneur, is disconnecting yourself from the actual results, but then crediting yourself with being, you know, for running the experiments, for sticking with it, for having grit.
It's like, trust the process. You know, like, it's like, you got to believe that the scientific method is going to win out eventually. And then you also have to be willing to admit that it's possible that you were, in fact, wrong.
Yeah.
You can't think about that every day because it's too terrifying, but you have to be like, I still get this. When I did that Kickstarter campaign, I was really nervous and I was worried, like, what if we do this campaign and no one shows up? And like, before
the
campaign,
to be embarrassing, like, God, you had this bestseller.
Super embarrassing. Then it's like, it's not, maybe the bestseller wasn't real, right?
Like, it sounds like a pretty dumb thing to do. I'll be totally honest. If you come off the success like this,
why do it again?
Yeah. It's a huge success. Like, I mean, it's so dumb to be like, oh, you know what? I had the best-selling book, like, on my first, this is your first book, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So you hit a home run on your first time at bat. And then you're like, yeah, I want to play lacrosse for the next
game. Oh, yeah, you should totally retire at the top, right? And then, like, get out of the game and go do something else. No, absolutely.
It's like a Michael Jordan going to play baseball. It's like, that's dumb.
Right.
But it turned out to not be. How did you get your publisher to agree to not just give you a huge check and to go do Kickstarter when we get back on This Week in Startups? Hey, everybody. Welcome back to This Week in Startups live at Microsoft Reactor. Awesome. My guest, Eric Ries, of course, the author of The Lean Startup, and he's got a new book coming out. What's the name of the new book?
It's called The Leader's Guide.
The Leader's Guide. And when I left you before this, that very important break, I was trying to understand why, you know, because listen, I understand the book business. You have a hit. I'm assuming you didn't get paid a ton for this. You probably got like a 50K advance or 100K advance.
I did fine.
Something modest. It wasn't huge. It was huge, huh? By that look, it looks kind of huge.
All things are relative. So,
well, anyway, yeah. you did okay.
They were very generous.
Let me just say
that
this didn't... Did the Kickstarter do better than the original? Did it outpace the original?
Oh, no. Well, this book has sold a lot of copies now.
No, but I'm saying the advance.
No, it didn't.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah. But your point is totally valid in that... Publishing, like a lot of media businesses, you follow up a hit.
You just do another hit.
You get it. Well, you know, it's a tournament system, so most authors don't make any money, and the few that actually have that kind of success get to reap all the rewards of the whole system. It's not actually the greatest system of all time, so I don't necessarily, you're not here to say, the system has been very good to me, so I don't want to say I'm not an unhappy author, my publisher is awesome.
But when you tell the publisher, hey, you know what, I'm going to go do a Kickstarter, isn't that like their greatest fear in the world that Kickstarter exists?
They were really nervous about it, and actually it took an extensive negotiation about how we were going to do it. And actually the thing that unlocked it for me, I was like, okay, what if I'm going to write a follow-up book? So to your point, like I had to get my ego out of it, because I was like, for me, I could just be the Lean Startup guy for the rest of my life.
Pretty good deal.
And it's a pretty good deal, and like that was a nice, very nice lifestyle. And I didn't have, you know, I could kind of do what I wanted to do.
Speaking gigs,
if you have a flop, then it's like you're not, you know, now you're the Lean Startup guy, but you had this flop. So then I was like, oh, that made me nervous. I took my ego out of it. So, okay, look, I have a set of things I want to say based on my work since the book came out. I mean, really, have worked with a lot of companies, and I feel like there's more to say. So I want to have that impact. It's not very lean if I like lock myself in a closet and just sit there and write for 2 years and then publish the book. I was like, that's kind of hypocritical. So I really ought to do some kind of minimum viable product. Otherwise, dude, you're the lean startup guy. Why didn't you do a minimum? So I was like, okay. So that's like the right thing to do. So I went to them. I said, listen, I want to do a minimum viable product. I want to prove to you that there's this market for this next book. And so let's make a deal where the Kickstarter campaign exists to serve the next traditionally published book.
Hmm.
So we did an omnibus deal at the time to cover the next several years of my life with them.
Wow.
So the Kickstarter campaign, that book is not to be sold in stores. And it's just for the people who back the campaign. It's just there as an experiment to see what happens when the ideas there get disseminated. People will try them. There's like a whole online community component to it. And so as we get their feedback about what happened in the real world, that informs the next book. And then I promise them they would still get to do their big published thing when they
want. Now, do they want the Leader's Guide to be a book?
They do. So then they were like, well, why do Kickstarter? We'll just buy both books from you. And I was like, okay, that's great. But then they don't have a model. How do you value an MVP book that's only a workbook that's designed for this experiment? And they couldn't figure out what to do with it. Because I was like, I don't want to sell it in stores. And I don't want to sell as many copies as possible. I want to sell as few copies as necessary to learn what I need to learn. That's the whole ethos of MVP. And they're like, what? Where's my vanity metrics, right? They're like, how many copies are you going to sell? I was like, you know, I'd like to, we could get it, keep it under 10,000. That would be great. And they're like, under? And they're like, so you want to charge a lot of money for it? I was like, no. This is not the purpose of this book is not to make profit in this book. That's really sub-optimizing the much bigger opportunity to create another monster bestseller like the Lean Startup. So they ultimately decided it was actually easier for them to only buy the next book and give me the rights to the Kickstarter campaign entirely. So now I own that thing outright. I can do whatever I want with it.
Very nice.
It's very handy, actually.
Take a look.
I think it's actually a true win-win for authors and publishers. And I think this is a model that other authors should copy. And so far, zero have that I'm aware of.
No, you know, I was actually thinking about it. And then I just got a big book offer and I just tug it.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was like setting up the whole Kickstarter. And then
it is a pain. Yeah.
It's a little bit of a pain. It's a lot of work. And then I just thought to myself, it looks kind of weird for an angel investor to be like, hey, can everybody give me a little bit of money to like do this thing, this book?
Yeah, that is a little weird.
It does feel a little weird.
I think I got some emails about that for sure.
Yeah.
But you have to have the conviction in, that's a good, to your point about ego. You have to have the conviction to say, look, I'm doing this campaign not to make money, but to get customer validation.
Got it.
So people said, why am I sending you money when you obviously made a lot of money already? I'm like, you're not sending me money. You're validating this product and buying it. And I committed to use the money we raised in the campaign to produce the book. And the reason we had such scope creep and the reason the whole thing is late is because we raised so much money, I felt the need to do more stuff. And it's just like, as soon as you start thinking that way, that's a dangerous road.
The other thing is too, is like, I don't think Robert Downey Jr. is like, oh my God, like I feel so guilty about playing Iron Man again in these next three Marvel movies because I'm buying the ticket. I'm like, right now, I just heard that Daniel Craig's not going to take 68 million pounds to play James Bond one more time. And I feel like, where does he live? Because I feel like I need to talk to him about this and just tell him, like, hey, schmuck, take the 68 million pounds and give it to charity and play James Bond one more time. Not for the money and not for the charity, but because I think you're the best Bond.
Right, because you want that as a customer.
I want the next Bond, please. For the love of God, I'll pay $20 a ticket. I love him as Bond.
Yeah, he's
your favorite Bond? Who's your favorite Bond?
Sean Connery, obviously.
Well, obviously.
Oh, come on.
Well, see, I agree
that.
I agree it's Sean Connery. But here's the thing. I just like the darker Bond.
Yeah.
I felt like if you like a light Bond who's funny and you like a little bit of that comedic thing, you have to go Sean Connery. But this dark Batman, Dark Knight, James Bond, I love it. You don't like it?
I feel like we have enough superheroes.
That's true.
I like the low stakes of the old Bond, right? Like not the whole world is going to be destroyed in a black hole, but like there's like a secret recording of something that would be a diplomatic snafu if it came to light. So let's go find it. Like what is it? What the MacGuffin? It doesn't matter what it is.
It's not like the big gemstone,
right? Why does it have to be an infinity gem? Every time. Okay, some movies can be that, but I don't need the. I feel like it's like scope creep of villains.
It is. All right. Let me take
no one came here for my movie criticism.
Sometimes we take little detours. It's a little test in the show. So let's talk a little. I want to talk about the revenue test I tried. And I got a little resistance internally. I said, here's what I want to do. I want to know if people will support an email newsletter.
There's
like 15,000 people on it. And I said, what's the quickest, easiest way to test this? So you remember the $1 million homepage?
Yeah.
You buy a pixel for whatever amount. And Alex Tu is the guy who created that.
Yeah.
He then created Calm.com, which I invested in when nobody would invest in it, and now it's doing very well. And I always remembered that concept because it's clever, right? And I said, okay, I'm going to sell a character in the glorious paragraph of patronage, just a paragraph at the end of the email newsletter, and it's $1 per day per character. And HustleCon and a couple other people bought like 7 or 8. So we made $2,500 for the month of... I said, it'll be 25 links, so we make that a month for the month. And I said, okay, well, this thing's costing, whatever, $10,000 a month to produce, something like that. This month, we did it again for June. Before we even opened it up, it's already exceeded last month. It'll probably do $10,000 a month, from 25 to 10. And all it is just a series of links.
Right.
No ad network, no developer, just a type form.
Yeah.
Fill out the type form with Stripe integration. One person made it in half a day.
Yeah, that's good.
What do you think of that, Tess?
Well, I have a concern.
Okay, that's why.
I mean, I like it. So in general, I think people always like wonder, like, why do revenue testing? Like, why is that important? I think what you need is not revenue, but validation. You need to know for sure that your customers really value this product. And if 0% of them will pay for it, that's a bad sign. So that part of it I really like. But I have a vanity metrics concern.
Okay.
Which is, we're talking about the gross revenue that you made from the thing. But first of all, there's two problems with that. One, maybe the novelty of you doing this new thing was part of the reason why people wanted to do it.
Right.
Secondly, I don't really know if $2,500 is a lot or a little in this situation. What I really want to know is, what's your revenue per customer over time?
Right.
And like, okay, well, your list was bigger, so of course the number went up. Hmm. But like, is this actually, like, if you look at it on a fully loaded cost basis, on a per customer basis, and you plug that into like whatever private business plan you have about what you hope this thing can become, how close to the end zone are we?
Right.
And like, if we're supposed to be making, you know, 12 cents per user per month, and we're making 1 cent, that's really different than if we're making, you know, 10 cents.
Ah.
Right? So like, how, like, order of magnitude, where are we? Like, not in the vanity
metrics,
but on a CPM basis or whatever.
Right.
Like, every business has kind of a core driver of like unit economics is kind of the phrase people are using for it now. But like, unit economics can be somewhat disturbing because it's like, what are your units here? You sell electrons to people at a markup?
Well, we do have one thing, which is the clicks. So we are tracking the clicks.
Yeah. So, you know, like, I think about it not in unit economics, but like per person economics, right? You have a certain number of customers, and obviously not all of them are going to pay you, but just if you average it out, you make a certain amount of money per customer per period. And so the two things I would want to know that you don't have to share it on live on the air, but the things I would want to know would be, one, is that number increasing or decreasing over time?
Yeah.
Right? Each time you run the experiment, hopefully you're getting better at targeting it so that
here's how I ran the second experiment.
Yeah, tell me.
I said, and I wrote this paragraph to the readership, because I've been transparent about what I'm doing. And I said, I know this seems like a de minimis amount of money. I want to see if this is actually viable and if we can actually hit break even in like 6 months. So I said, next month, instead of having 25 links, we'll have 50. And instead of charging 50 cents per newsletter, $1 per day, we'll charge $1 per newsletter, $2 per day.
Yep.
So we'll basically double the number of links and double the amount of money. And then we're going to have the wall of heroes, which will be 10 avatars, which you can use your Twitter avatar, your Instagram avatar,
right,
and that's 500 a month.
Yeah.
So that'd be another 5,000, and the other stuff would be 10. So if it hits 15, we will be well beyond break even.
Yeah.
And that's based on the current number of readers.
Yeah.
And so we're going to launch that next week, and we'll see.
Yeah.
And we know how many opens we have, 250,000 opens a week.
Yeah.
So
that's another good vanity metric.
The opens are?
Yeah.
Well, not the subs would be the vanity, but the opens would
be. Well, anything that's the gross number, the things that make your competitors want to die, to be like, oh, he's already got so many open, so why should I even bother?
Oh, okay,
that's
good.
Listen, we're on the air. So
a nice,
great,
intimidating one.
Yeah, exactly. Like, definitely brag about it. But again, what I want to know is, is your opens per customer per period increasing or decreasing over time?
Oh, they're increasing.
On a
every
cohort
week,
by cohort basis.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would...
Every month, 10%.
The experiment I would urge you to do also is take a random subsample of your customers, 1,000 of them or something, and send them a different thing that you're planning to do. Just be like, if you want to continue to be a subscriber, you got to pay $10.
Yeah.
Or whatever, like some other revenue generating thing that's like not glamorous and exciting, but it's just like, or like do it NPR pledge drive style. Like, this is Jason Calacanis pledge drive week, and we please give us $10 a month or whatever you're like.
Yeah.
Make an ask that is kind of sort of similar to what you're asking for on this thing, and see what your conversion rate difference is. Because then you'll be able to understand how much of the value you're getting in this ad campaign is the underlying value that people are getting out of this newsletter that they want to give back to you.
Yeah.
And how much of it is they're excited about this clever gimmick to get free advertising
right.
for their thing, and they get their avatar and get famous and whatever. And then you'll find out which of those two businesses you're in. Like, are you in the news business at all? Or is news just a clever loss leader for your cool gimmick?
Yeah.
That lets people get famous on their avatar, and then you can decide, is that actually a business I want to be in?
Yeah.
Which I have no judgment about which of those businesses you should be in, but like,
fascinating.
Figure out which of them you actually are in right now so you can optimize accordingly.
Okay, now here's the next experiment.
All right.
We wanted to know if we should do, there was a big internal debate.
Mm-hmm.
When should we release the newsletter every day?
Yep.
And then what amount of news are we going to miss by the nature of doing that?
Yeah.
And I said we should do two newsletters every day, one in the morning, one at the night, because I think everybody's going to filter them anyway. They're kind of getting filtered in Google. You can skip it if you want, but it's kind of nice to get into a cadence that every, in the morning and the afternoon, you have your coffee in the morning, you have a coffee in the afternoon, you get like a little update. Like they get, this is my theory.
You send it the same time every day or in their local time zone?
Right. Well, that's the other issue. We do the same time every day for everybody because it's a United States newsletter.
Yeah.
But we tested that. But the first thing we tested was, would there be any difference in one a day or two a day?
Yeah.
It turned out when we sent two a day, the same open and click rates as one.
Probably if you sent three or four or five, probably the same. It's crazy. It doesn't make sense.
It didn't make sense. Everybody's like, well, people will unsubscribe. Didn't nobody unsubscribe?
Yeah. So internet marketing and everything related to customer behavior is weird that way. Like, I mean, I was working with a startup once, and they were charging, I can't remember what they were charging, X dollars per person per month to use their product, some kind of commercial product. And I was like, how much experimentation have you done with that price point? And they were like, none. We just know it's the right price point. It's just that same. I was like, just will you humor me and do an experiment? Absolutely not. We know it's the right price point. I was like, our customers are always complaining about how expensive it is. There's no way. So it's like, okay, let's translate your feeling about this into a hypothesis. Your hypothesis is if I drew a curve of conversion rate against price point, then it's a beautiful upside down U shape. You have the optimal pot. And if we move, you change the price at all, the conversion rate will go down. They're like, exactly. I was like, so if you humor me because you're paying me a lot of money to be your consultant and do this thing with you, let's do some experiments at different price points. And they were like, okay, how about we like make it $26 instead of $25? And I was like, no, I want it to be $150 instead of $25 just for kicks. I think I said 10X. I think I said $250 and then we negotiated down to $150. So my opening bid was nice and high, like you did with Microsoft. That was good. So we negotiated down to, it was very different than the original price point. And they did the experiment and conversion rates were unchanged. And they were like, that can't be right. It doesn't make sense. I thought it was so, people complain about how expensive it is. And like, they're still complaining. You get the same rate of complaints. Like user behavior was totally identical at the two price points. And then I was like, we got to go up 10X again, right? And I couldn't get them to even run the experiment. They didn't even want to know how valuable their product actually was to their customers. So this is like goes to the humility point. You just don't know what customers are going to do. And it's not always logical because we have this like very specific mental model of what's going on. It's just often wrong.
Can you imagine if I told people in 1980 that coffee would be $4.50 or $6?
Yeah, of course not.
It would just blow people's mind. They're like, you mean like hot water through the grinds is $6? Is it in a magic cup or is it like, do you put gold leaf on top of it? But people go and pay for milk, sugar, and coffee $4, $5, $6, $7 in this town.
And feel like it's worth it. Because I think you got like, this is, you know, pricing 101, but I think a lot of us lose sight of this. It's like the cost of a product to a customer should be proportional not to what it costs you to produce, not to how you feel about producing it, not to what you feel comfortable saying with a straight, it should be proportional to the marginal value you deliver to the customer. And value is defined in emotional terms and the terms that people actually care about. And sometimes the perceived value to the customer is way higher than what it costs you to make. That's why soda and coffee and these things are good product, like good businesses. And it's why like fundamentally almost all software has no marginal cost and yet we feel comfortable charging people money for it because that's, you should charge people what it's worth. And it goes back to this conversation we started out with like the community development and the feeling of your customers as your partners. If you really take that seriously, then you'd say, if I charge you less than what the product is worth to you, then I have to underinvest in making the product bigger and growing our community. Is that really what you want? Yeah. And I think most customers, if they were, you know, obviously they have, feel the need to negotiate with you. So they're like, no, I want to pay the minimum possible. But like, I think if people, you really think about the products that you really love, the artists that you really admire, the authors you want to support, you feel good about paying money to support them because you know that ultimately furthers the thing itself happening.
It would be like you saying like, oh yeah, buy my book. I'll make it half price, but there's going to be, nobody's going to proof it for spelling errors or typos.
Right. It's going to be worse.
Be like, you because, know what? I'll pay the 20. Go ahead and proof it.
Yeah, right. Make it as good as you can. And I just think that that's true in a lot of... It's true. You can tell that it's true because we use the word professional as a compliment.
Huh.
We have a built-in belief that someone who gets paid money to do something for a living is better at it than an amateur. And not only is better at it, they bring a certain like pride and sophistication to their work that is difficult for an amateur to do. Not in every single field, but like in most fields, that's what we believe. And I think that's right. I think there's something, there's like a wisdom in that that says, look, if you're going to build a product and make it viable, you and your customers both want this to be a sustainable business. And so let's work together to make that happen.
I want to get your take on the technology industry, just stepping outside of just building startups, but just the tech industry in general. Just a quick lightning round.
Mm-hmm.
Apple making a car. What are your thoughts on that and what their approach to be doing? I know it's a total curve.
No, listen, I'm not very newsy because like I just love when someone does something audacious.
Yeah.
Period. So I just can't, like, it's hard for me to believe that it's a good idea. I don't feel like there's any like real rational case out there that this is a good idea, except I love the audacity of it, and I feel like as cars become smartphones on wheels, like why are the wheels more important than the smartphone? I don't know. I don't know at all. But I find that like I'll line up for that car.
Self-driving cars.
Inevitable and great. I think it'd be so great. I mean, imagine our grandkids.
Yeah.
They're gonna be like, you're gonna be like, back in my day, Sonny. Right? Like in my day, it'd be like we let people just drive the cars, you know, while they were distracted and on their phone and eating, you know, put on their makeup, whatever. And they're gonna be like, and that was safe. And it's like, oh no, tons of people died every day from it. Just be like, and why is that? What? You let people die?
We painted lines on the road and told people to try to stay inside.
Yeah, and like when you drive down the street, you were just trusting that the random human being on the other lane wasn't going to randomly swerve and hit you. And then they'd be like, okay, if that was one person, I'd be like, but no, thousands of people are driving. Yeah. And they're like, you mean random people? And you're like, yeah, bell curve distribution of intelligence, of conscientiousness, of skill. Random people driving against you, and you're like, our grandkids are going to find this very... I'm hoping our kids will find this difficult to understand. I'm very bullish on that.
What do you think about VR and then subsequently AR, augmented reality?
Well,
these are big trends, but are they going to actually show up this time?
This is going to be vindication for me. People forget before I did Lean Startup, I was a 3D avatars guy. Right. Did InView and back before that, Dare.com. So I've been a believer in the metaverse and virtual reality, all these things for a long time. The lesson that I learned the hard way, and we built our whole thesis of InView around it, was that if you're going to do VR or AR for communication between human beings and not for cool demos, then you need an expressive medium where even though we're not physically in the same place, we can express emotional cues with each other. And it can't be real video based if it's VR because I got the stupid thing on my face.
Right.
So I look like an idiot.
Yeah.
So I don't want to appear in video as a picture of how I actually look with the thing on my face, because that's a moment where I look stupidest.
Right.
So you're obviously going to need, for any kind of telepresence, communication between people. And whether we're talking about dating or business, you know, like business meetings that are done in VR, like whatever the use case, you're going to need high quality expressive avatars. And that's a much harder problem than people think. So the world is finally going to come around to our era 2004 thesis for InView. And then maybe someone will finally buy the damn company.
You were 12 years early.
Yeah.
And it might take another couple of years. Have you ordered one of the headsets? So you have an Oculus on order or anything?
I have not. When I left InView, I was like, I am done with the 3D. Like I had been working on that same problem space for a long time. And I was like, I'm done with 3D stuff. People used to call me to consult on their new 3D. I was like, I don't want any 3D.
Too much scar tissue.
Too much scar tissue. But then when Oculus came out, I was like, oh, that sounds so cool. I was like, nope, don't do it. I talked myself out of it. But then that, since I didn't do it at the very beginning, now I kind of feel like I have to stick to it. So yeah, I've stubbornly resisted using any of the new tech, although I hear it's incredible.
Let's talk about AI, machine learning.
Yep.
obviously, this is another one of these things. You and I have been in the industry for a while. It just keeps coming up, keeps coming up. And we see, you know, little tiny verticals of it, playing chess, playing Go. You know, the Google's Go thing won.
I used to go, anytime AI came up, I would just be like, call me when it beats Go.
And that and happened
I was
this
like,
year.
And I was like, I figured that was like, then my kids could have this conversation with somebody. But I would never have to take AI.
Why Go?
I mean, if you've never played Go, I really strongly recommend it. It's the most incredible game.
How many people
game.
Have played Go or play Go?
Oh, man. We got to get a higher penetration in the industry. And I'm thrilled. The Google Go AI match
play
like it. What's that?
I want to play Go. You teach me. You got to teach me.
I'll teach you. Yeah.
I want to play that. Oh, it'd be like a cool thing for us to do at the club.
Yeah, you got it.
You just play Go.
Sold.
Can you play Go for money? I mean, is there a money gambling aspect to this?
Like, well, there are professional players, but I don't know that there's a gambling scene. You have to go to Japan and ask people.
We can start it.
Go gambling. Okay.
Per stone. But how does Go work? Explain to me why.
The reason it's incredible from a machine learning point of view is it has two things that are really unique about it among games. The first is the search space of how big it is really crazy. It's a 19 by 19 grid, so way bigger than a chessboard. Every piece is the same, and pieces don't move. So at any time, you can, roughly speaking, play your move at any of the 19 by 19 squares that's not occupied. So the search space of a Go game is, roughly speaking, 19 squared factorial possible moves, which is a number so astronomically large that people thought, okay, that's a really difficult space. But chess has a really difficult search space also, and we did solve chess through brute force, which is just like you throw enough computers at it. Moore's Law means that, like, if you can't make it work this year, like, try again next year, and we keep trying until the weight of the computational power gets us there. But Go has a second really interesting attribute that makes it much more like, you know, much more like focus on human intelligence and pattern oriented, which is that from a strategic point of view, there's a macro micro thing. At any given time, you can kind of evaluate. It's actually hard to tell who's winning. It requires skill in Go to figure out which of the two players is winning at any given time, because every stone has like a micro influence, but then it also has influence that ripples out through the whole game.
Hmm.
And every once in a while, if you are playing, especially when you're playing someone who's a lot better than you, you think everything's going fine, and then something really unexpected happens, and like not only is it not going fine anymore, but you're actually losing by a lot. It's like a catastrophically bad outcome. And like, I don't know what the right like sports metaphor for this is, but like it's pretty unusual among games for things to go so crazy wrong so quickly.
It's kind of like boxing Mike Tyson or something. It seems like you're doing okay until you
you're knocked out.
Then you're on the floor.
From a computational point of view, why that's so interesting is that in order to cut down the search space, you develop heuristics. So like, for example, like a very simple heuristic would be like, okay, searching 19 by 19 would be really difficult, but I'll divide the board into four quadrants. And I'll view this as four independent little mini games, and I'll figure out who's ahead in the four quadrants, and I'll probably be okay. And they're like, well, that worked pretty well. I'll divide it into eight quadrants. You know, I keep cutting the search space down until I can kind of get my handle on this area is going well, this going well, going well. And then I don't have to search quite as far. Except, this tiny little move over here, which is supposed to be independent from what's happening on the diametrically opposite side of the board. Oops.
Now they relate.
Now I have to recompute the whole damn thing. And since in order to do search, you have to be able to recompute all the possible moves, now you're back to the terrible search space. So the reason human beings are so good at it and machines until very recently were so bad at it is you can develop a very like powerful pattern recognition ability that humans are really good at. You can kind of feel the professional players talk about this in spooky terms, like you feel the energy of the stones as they radiate out. And it's an Eastern game, so like when these things get translated into English and you're an English player, you start to be like, I don't want to hear about the energy anymore, just like tell me what to do, right? I want checkmate,
yeah.
Right? I want to win. It's like, well, actually there's a wisdom to that. You see how the game evolves and then you can become really good at it. So the idea that Google could produce in 2016 an AI that's so good that it can feel the energy of the game and make moves that professional players view as like beautiful.
Mm.
And like even as an amateur, watching the transcript of the game unfold, I can't even, these games are played at a level far beyond my ability to play. Like you can't even describe how much better these players are than I am. Even I could see there was like a real beauty to the game. And it's like, it's actually very spooky to me that was a computer playing.
So,
anyway, sorry for the Go digression.
No, it's very helpful. Are we on the precipice of something incredible when it comes to AI?
Definitely.
In 2016. I get that sense too.
It's time. And it's not AI.
Is it just the Moore's Law, or is it the algorithms? We're writing better things, or we're building upon APIs?
There's two things that are happening, right? Like the brute, like if you think about the two aspects of Go that make it interesting, there's been breakthroughs in both of those areas. So we've gotten really good at you know, at kind of building these more complicated neural networks with multiple levels of feedback in them, so we can model more complex phenomena. But really, we have the raw computational power to run those networks against truly astronomical data sets that we didn't have before. And because AI is all about training and learning, the ability to do that is super valuable. But we've also had some conceptual breakthroughs in the techniques to wire up the networks to do the pattern recognition. So when people talk about deep learning, it's actually kind of two related breakthroughs coming together in something that's super tangible. So, like, I mean, if you told me, I was a computer science major, I graduated from school in 2000. If you told me in 2000 that not only within my lifetime, but that would, like, within 15 years, we would have self-driving cars that are, like, almost commercially viable and Go would be a solved problem in computer science, like, I really would have considered that crazy. And I thought at that time that I understood exponential growth, but I obviously didn't. So I'm like, okay, don't do that again. Like, got to understand that the good things are coming here.
Okay, so we went from inside the startup to the big picture in technology. Let's just keep going out another orbit. Humanity, geopolitical issues, and employment for the world.
I thought you were going to say Trump. I was really worried. Don't ask. I can't even talk about it.
We can go there in a second, but because that is an interesting one in terms of a lean startup and the way he's run that campaign, isn't it?
That is true.
I mean, he has. Talk about testing.
You said you weren't going to go there.
Well, we're here.
What was your question about employment? Let's talk about
that. Well, the big picture is you and I and a lot of people in the room are seeing this massive advances, right? It feels
incredible.
Like things are going faster, and we're the vanguard, and we thought it would go fast, but it's exceeding our own pace.
Yeah, we underestimated.
We underestimated. So for the people who were the ultimate optimists to underestimate, and we might still be underestimating.
I'm sure.
It kind of feels like this is a velocity that could have ramifications beyond the normal, well beyond the normal.
It's going to be a gut-wrenching change. I think we have to go so far as to be thinking about renegotiating the social contract in the way our societies are built from a, like, civics point of view. And we have to take this seriously because our employment, education, you know, tax, like, all of our, like, policies are not, they're designed for an industrial world that is not dealing with this kind of exponential change. And the reason exponential change is so difficult is not just that things change quickly, but the categories change. What used to be expensive becomes inexpensive all of a sudden, right? So, like, what makes something like Uber possible is, like, the coordination overhead required to do Uber is, like, goes from, you know, so difficult that we had to artificially restrict supply and, like, all this whole, like, civic infrastructure for taxis because it was, like, this incredibly difficult problem. And you think about, like, the taxis in Manhattan, all the work and energy. And then it's, like, problem solved with software.
Yeah.
So, like, impossible to solve and now, like, completely solved and it costs nothing. And so now a business that used to have, like, this scarcity economics goes to post-scarcity economics and then, like, causes all these problems. And in the grand scheme of things, Uber is, like, one of the more minor changes that we're going to deal with. Like, and that's, like, a multi-billion dollar opportunity. Like, think of how big the next wave of changes is going to be. Like, when people take their home, like, 3D, people all freaked out about 3D printing. I'm like, forget that. 3D bioprinting, start to get worried about that. I download the molecule off the internet and I print it in my home. And, like, uh-oh. I was like, oh, not just a molecule, biological organism. I could download the DNA and replicate that in my kitchen. And then I'm like, oh, you know what? I'd like to do germline editing for my offspring. I'm sure that'll be fine. Like, we are not equipped for these kind of, like, crazy, crazy changes that are not, like, 5 years away, but, like, they're really coming.
Yeah, we're talking about quarters, months. We're no longer in the decades. It was very safe as a pundit to be like, yes, two or three decades, we'll be there. And now it's like, you say two or three decades, it's like, yeah.
A lot of these things are coming sooner than we think. But on the other hand, so there's a whole thing about people worried about there's not going to be employment anymore and the rise of the robots. And, you know, I'm not a believer in that thesis, really. I think that...
You're not, I am.
I think...
Explain why a robot is not going to replace every manual labor job.
Oh, all crappy jobs are going to be replaced for sure.
Great.
I just think human
beings
are infinitely good at coming up with new jobs to do. So I think if we're willing to spend the money as a society and really invest in entrepreneurship and education, which is a big if, right? So that we have not proven we are able to do that. But if we're willing to make that investment to say, if someone's displaced from their job, because of changes in globalization or technology. We shouldn't just let them languish as the unemployed, but we should be investing in them, helping them, you know, make the transition to a new industry. We should help them become an entrepreneur. But listen, you think, okay, we're all clapping here, but like, I was on C-SPAN once. I'll tell you this one story. I was on C-SPAN, I was making the case, I call this a pro-entrepreneurship public policy, not left, not right, but what do you need to do to invest in the next generation of entrepreneurs? And I was just like, I'm on C-SPAN in the daytime. I was like there at like 10 o'clock on a Tuesday, okay? So this is like, who's watching a live call-in show on C-SPAN at that hour? You can imagine
Insomniacs.
The calls I'm getting, yeah. It was like some pretty funny calls. Anyway, I was like, listen, I'm just rattling off this idea, that idea, in my usual way. We currently give unemployment insurance payments to someone who becomes involuntary laid off, right? I was like, you know, in some countries, they have a program where if you want, you can choose to convert your unemployment insurance payments into a small business loan and use that to start a business. So you go from being, you know, unemployed person to job creator, and the government funds that, and then
that's a nice swing.
It's like, I cannot come up with a policy that seems more obvious to me. It's like so clearly a good idea.
So you say, here's what your year of unemployment would be.
Here's your small business loan.
We'll give you a loan, you a year in advance, you're not getting any more unemployment.
Yeah, it's like you were just the same money we would have paid you anyway, but now we'll do it through a small business program. And in certain countries, it comes with like training about entrepreneurship, and you learn how to do it, and they help you get some incubator space. Whatever. It's like a whole program for helping people go from unemployed to entrepreneurs. Greatest idea ever. So easy. First caller. What happens if they don't pay back their loans? Government giving them free loans, they don't get paid back. It's like, well, we were giving them the unemployment anyway. So let's say that 1% of the people pay it back, then the government's ahead. I was not going to win this argument. You can see what was going on. I was just like, but then the other people, you know, are undeserving.
What about the people who are going to work every day?
Right, exactly. Like, why didn't I get it? Like, they got this free loan, and I didn't. I go to work every day. I was just like,
they're taking our jobs.
That is really what it was. And every one of these policies, you know, you talk about, like, the simple ones and the hard ones. Like, so in California, we have strong prohibitions on anti-compete clauses in contracts. Okay? Now, that's considered a left policy, right? It's like pro-worker to say, like, you know, the company cannot block you up with these things, so it's a pro-worker policy. You know, where some policies that are
important... You can't do a non-compete.
You can't do a non-compete.
They're not valid here, but in the East Coast, if you give somebody a non-compete and say, you can't work for a software company...
Yeah, they're valid there. So if you have a Boston-based company, then they're valid. If you have a New York... Every company thinks they need non-competes. Even California companies, they write them into their contracts anyway, even though they're unenforceable. It'd be like, we need the control. It's a human tick. We can't let go. It's a matter of public policy. We have to say you can't do this. It's part of why Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley, and Route 128 in Boston didn't become the next Silicon Valley, because we have a series of policies that make that possible. So, you know, that, like, is that a right? So we have to have that prohibition if you want to have a pro-entrepreneurship public policy. Is that a right thing or a left thing? Like, it's kind of confusing, because, like, on the one hand, you think, well, having a giveaway to business, that's the right thing, but then like tax policy, it's just like we get confused because we're used to thinking about business or workers. Pro-entrepreneurship public policy is interesting because you have to ask yourself, when someone becomes an entrepreneur, statistically speaking, what were they doing 5 minutes before they became an entrepreneur? Now, maybe they were Elon Musk and he's doing his second startup, but statistically speaking, so statistically
Hyperloop.
Speaking, it's not very likely that the person who becomes an entrepreneur was an entrepreneur before. So what were they? They were a student, they were an immigrant, they were a worker. Or they
unemployed.
Were unemployed. They probably weren't a titan of industry. They probably weren't a Fortune 500 CEO, statistically speaking, right? So we have to create policies that help those people become future titans of industry. So on the one hand, it's very left in that you like, we gotta help these dispossessed people have the freedom to take a risk to do this. I remember I was on Fox News once, and I was like, don't say anything about Obamacare. Don't say anything about Obamacare. I was like, just don't say it. Don't say it. Don't say it. And of course, like, they asked me. It was like the segment turns out to be, I'm in the segment about the evils of Obamacare. And I was like, well, but I think Obamacare is very pro-entrepreneurship, because if you are going to quit your job and take a risk at a startup, but you have kids and you can't get health insurance, you're going to put your kids' health at risk to do a startup? Of course you're not. And I personally have tried to recruit in the old bad old days. I used to try to convince people in Silicon Valley to quit their affluent job at, you know, Adobe or whatever, and like become an entrepreneur. Yeah. And they'd be like, I would do it, but like, what's your story for my kid's health insurance? And I'd be like, oh, it's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. But like, I was totally bullshitting. Of course it was going to be horrible, and they would have to deal with the insurance market before it was god-awful. So anyway, I didn't – the segment did not go well. But I think that
Neil Cavuto was not pleased.
Yeah, you know, I think Steve Forbes was on the segment, and I can't remember who else, but like they were looking at me just like shaking their heads. Like, who
no, you're the sacrificial lamb when you come on as anybody who's not super right.
I didn't mean to be political. I was just trying to say we want people to be worried about the capital gains rate. Because they're creating so much wealth that they want the cut. Like we want people to join the ranks of future hyper-conservative rich people. So let's just help them make that happen. But then, once they become an entrepreneur, we can't have super stifling regulations about how you create companies. So in the U.S., we do a pretty good job. Like a lot of federal employment regulations don't apply to companies under 50 people, which I think is really smart. In a lot of European countries, that's not true. And so like you have a three-person startup, and now, you know, you have to post that big labor poster, and if you don't do this thing, you could be sued for this, sued for that. And like, so there's like pro-entrepreneurship public policy is kind of perfectly calibrated to piss everybody off and have reasons why nobody would like it, which is why I think we have an industry. We have to really think about how do we build a political coalition around these ideas? And the time is now. We don't have a lot of time to waste on this because the world is going to change on us. And if we don't get with it, we're going to be in big trouble.
I find it fascinating that we're still doing so well, considering how absolutely disastrous our political system seems at times. You know, it's like from the 80s, the 90s, and then on into the new millennium, like it's been like people have been writing the obituary for America, and yet we still seem to make these really great companies that just go right across the globe, and we outperform per capita everybody. We still do such an amazing, amazing job of innovating.
Well, first of all, we're doing pretty well, but there are people in this country who are not doing well.
That's a huge problem.
Let's not forget that. And that's a huge problem. We who are doing well have a moral obligation to do something about that. Second thing I would say is I'm very bullish on America. You seen Hamilton yet?
I haven't.
Get thee to New York and see it.
Yeah,
it's incredible. I don't want to add more hype to the Hamilton hype because I actually think like it's going to encourage people not to see it. But like it's so much, it's better even than what you've heard in the hype. It's so great. But I think there is a certain genius in the American political system that makes it robust against these kinds of problems by making it difficult to get things done for the government. And I know I am very well versed in the arguments why that's a bad idea. And there are huge downsides to it. But like somehow, some way we have managed as a society to like become invested in these norms, and it's allowed us to build this system that has, you know, incorporated a lot of different perspectives over the years, but allow the system to kind of dynamically change but not go too crazy at any one time.
It's a bit of a stalemate. Change is slow.
But it's punctuated equilibrium. So like, yeah. You work really hard to make progress with your political coalition, and when you really earn it, you have these opportunities to make dramatic change, but you don't get to do that every year, and it requires party discipline, it requires building coalitions across interest groups, and like, you know, I think James Madison knew what he was talking about. But we are about to go through, we are right now going through like the crisis that the political scientists who study these kind of systems say our kind of constitutional republic is vulnerable to, because a demagogue with absolutely no principles, who's willing to kind of violate all democratic norms and kind of say whatever it takes, and there's enough angry people to kind of give them just a bare plurality of one political party, like that is actually a system. Like we don't have the antibodies for that, like we would in a parliamentary system. So, you know, I like politics a lot. I find politics very interesting. I really study political philosophy. I personally have my personal politics are all over the place, but normally, I don't talk about politics, and
it's so hard for us to talk about it because
it's so difficult, right?
You make any statement, and even if you're just trying to have a reasoned discussion, if you give the biggest disclaimer, I don't know my position on this.
Yeah,
but here's what
you
I'm thinking about. Everybody attacks you.
Like, yeah.
Let me think about immigration. What would be the most reasonable way to deal with mass immigration occurring because large number of people are being displaced?
Yeah.
That are from culturally different places. I don't know exactly. I'm not an expert on this. How do you deal with that?
You definitely shouldn't have just said that live on the air.
But if I say that live on the air, people are like, oh my God, are you pro-Muslim, anti-Muslim? Are you pro-terrorist? I don't know. I don't know what the right solution to immigration
society,
is.
Society, not knowing is an ideologically charged statement because certain things are so important, you really should have known. So anyway, so I'm not moralistic about it, okay? I'm really not.
What do you think should happen with mass migration?
I don't mind getting yelled at. I'm very happy to be pro-immigration. But that's going to taint what I'm about to say next. But I feel like there's a range of political opinions that are morally defensible. Like someone voted for John McCain. I didn't vote for McCain. I didn't vote for Romney. But I view it as morally acceptable to have done that. I'm like, Yeah, those were honorable people. You know, I was very happy to campaign. I was involved in those campaigns. I cared a lot about them. I thought the outcome was important enough to support the current president, but I never bore any ill will to any of the people who were on the other side. And in fact, I voted for George W. Bush. And when I went to volunteer on the Obama campaign, it was very striking to me that no volunteer ever gave me a hard time about it. No one ever made me feel welcome. People understood that, like, people disagree. They come around, like, you know, the Iraq War turned out to have been a bad idea. And, like, those of us who supported it, like, we should have learned our lesson. So, like, there was a dialogue and a process about that. So I would say politics is normally something everyone just have your private opinion. Don't be lording. But it is not morally acceptable to support Trump. I'm sorry. It's not.
Yeah.
It's simply not. And I can't, like, we having a political conversation with you and say, well, it's no big deal, because this is a difference in kind, not a difference in degree, to the kind of disputes we've had in the recent past. And it requires people who are apolitical to stand up and say, it's time to get political. I have to stand up for the American constitutional system that has served us all so well, and we can't have someone going around violating those norms without consequence. And not just that, those who support and enable him have to be given the same treatment. I really think that. So.
Okay. So what do you, why do you think he's hitting such a chord with so many people?
It's called racism.
You think it's just straight up racism?
Yeah. I do. I mean, I think that's how it started. Now, once, like, politics is funny. Once you win something, then there's people who are for you for the original thing that helped you win, and there's some people who are for you because you're a winner. And Trump's really done a good job of making that his brand. So I don't say that every person who supports Trump today is a racist, but I think anyone who is not really accounting for the role that racism played in his original rise, and like the fact that he was like the leading birther attacker of the president, and you know, just the people who enabled him and kind of made that mainstream, I just feel like that there's a kind of a corruption in our civic life that exposed that we're going to have to reckon with. It's going to be ugly.
He does seem to he used the racial card,
yeah,
and the xenophobia to get attention.
Yep.
He did what he was really good at, which is the personal politics at debates, the showmanship, the reality, yeah, TV star training to knock everybody out.
Yeah,
they didn't know what was coming.
They did not.
Just knocked everybody off their feet. And now I don't know if you saw his one talk about foreign policy.
I saw it.
And I was listening to that, and I'm listening to it with my wife, and I said, oh my God, he's doing it. He's literally mixing absolutely fundamentally good ideas with evil so perfectly,
mm-hmm,
that you're going to have... There's a hypnotic technique called the rabbit hole, which is I say things to you that are true, second statement true, third statement true, fourth statement true, fifth statement not true, sixth statement true, seventh statement
true. Right, you bury it in there.
And it's buried in there. And this is how masterful hypnosis practitioners,
yeah,
including L. Ron Hubbard, who was one of the great stage
you're really trying to get us in trouble
of all
today.
Time. I know. No, it's true. He was L. Ron Hubbard was a massively great hypnotist and stage hypnotist in that. And so I realized he's basically hypnotizing people. Where he said one of the great brilliant lines I've heard in foreign policy that if you attribute it to any rational person would sound like a great one, which is, we are no longer going to go around the world looking for wars.
Right.
And everybody, if I told you Hillary Clinton said that, if I told you Bill Clinton said it, if I told you Obama said it, if I told you Bernie Sanders said it,
yep,
you'd say, great, yes, we do not want to look for wars. Wars are not the answer to anything, especially in
that's
the Middle East.
That's the ultimate straw man argument. It's who's out there, I'm looking for a war. Right?
Right.
Like, no one's out there. That's like, I mean, it's right. Just, it's demagoguery 101. If you read the ancient Greeks on what they were afraid of with democracy and people who, you know, they called them sophists, right? People who are willing to make whatever argument it takes to win, that there's a kind of danger. There's a real danger in that. And I think... I don't know. I will see if our media and kind of political and civic landscape can handle this level of shamelessness. I'm not 100% convinced that we can.
The media has collapsed, and they are just going for ratings, and they will give him any amount of airtime that increases ratings.
Yeah.
He's hacked the system in that
way.
Yes.
I used to joke when I first got became a big advocate of A-B testing for startups and stuff, that one of the dangers in that, like the reason we talk so much about the scientific method and vision and everything in Lean is that if you just, you have to have some kind of thing that you stand for that you're testing to see if it's true. If you just sit there and turn the crank and do tests and like, do like, well, whatever makes the numbers go up and to the right, I'll do that. Like pretty soon you'll be selling pornography. And then you're like, a lot of people are like, oh God, that's not what I, you know, I didn't mean to do. I've seen companies where that has in fact happened to them. It's very dangerous. And then if you take back here, like that's what's happened. I mean, that's
Flickr,
this is what, exactly
Reddit,
what we're looking
and
at.
Tumblr all had or have massive adult entertainment components
right.
that were sort of like hidden in plain sight, but that was the growth, underground growth.
Yeah, so like, you know, and most companies, you get confronted with this existential crisis of like, okay, if you did that, do you want to pull back from the brink and get back on your mission and accomplish something? And like for our, I feel like the news and media world has been going through this crisis as the internet hollows out their business, these huge legacy business models. And it's like, listen, what do you stand for? Why do you exist? Is it really just to put out whatever on screen would give you the highest ratings? Because guess what? You don't need commentators for that. But then, like, we already have that on late night TV, so why do we need you?
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, Trump. I'm like, okay, that's just the next best thing. But I hope that this will cause a national reckoning, and I am actually very bullish about the idea that this could somehow, like, we could transmute this negative thing into a positive thing by, again, if, as citizens saying we have to re-engage and take a hard look at which of our institutions enabled this and who opposed. Like, my prediction is that Trump is going to go down in flames. I don't think he'll be president, but that when we have the national reckoning afterwards, we're going to have to look at which are the people and institutions that supported this and kind of convinced themselves that this was okay and who didn't. And the ones that didn't, we need to have a reckoning about, do they, like, why do they exist and what caused them to go so awry?
In a way, almost like the post 9/11.
It is just like that.
Where we all had to sit back and say, like, what? Do we need to go into Iraq? Exactly. Why did we go there? Why did we cover up the Saudi connection? And why are we in a police state with the NSA?
Right. And maybe we never really had that reckoning. And this, you know, this is part of what why we're all in some ways to blame for this. I don't know. I mean, I think.
Chances Trump wins. Percentage. 10%? 20? 5? What's your gut?
Nate Silver's really gotten in big trouble lately with his
forecasting. Because he said
forecasting.
It was an impossibility, right?
And I still think it's an impossibility, but I thought it then too. And now everyone, all my friends, people, my circle of friends, people ask me about for political advice all the time. I'm politically connected. So I told everybody, don't worry about it. He'll never be the nominee. You don't have to worry about it. And now I'm telling them, don't worry, he'll never be the president. And they're like, you know, you just said that. Here's the reason I think it's basically 0%, is that the error we all made in failing to forecast his rise was to look at the polls and say, the polls can't be right. There's some other reason why he can't be the nominee. But now the polls are all saying that he's going to lose. And so I'm like, okay, well, I learned my lesson. Let's go with the polls. If he starts to lead in the polls, I'll revise my estimation. But I just don't believe he can be president. I have enough faith in America to believe that it is, in fact, a 0% chance he cannot be president.
I thought this was an impossibility at the moment he attacked McCain.
Yeah, a lot of people thought that.
So outrageous to take somebody who's a war hero and say that you're in favor of the war heroes who don't get caught. It's the most offensive thing. The people who go out there and fight for our freedom, and he didn't go close to being involved in any engagement.
He was a draft dodger.
Is it? Well, okay. And
let's be honest about it.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus.
So he dodges it, and then he says the person who was tortured, and by the way, John McCain, because of his stature, was able to leave the POW camps early. He said, no, I'm staying.
That's right.
I'm going to stay. He voluntarily stayed with his men. Think about that. How outrageous a statement to say that that person is anything other than a hero. To me, it's so disgusting and so vile. How could you ever give that person any ounce of credibility? Yet, here we are. Here we are.
Here we are. Listen, but I hear that, and yet these are the same people that ran the Swift Boat ads against John Kerry. And that was somehow okay. So why is that okay and this isn't okay? Like, I think, again, about the idea of the reckoning, we as a society have said some things are okay that are not. And we're like, now everyone who's trying to figure out how do I criticize Trump has their own hypocrisy problems. And it's like, wait a second. You know, and listen, I was no John Kerry fan, but that was disgusting. Just like this was disgusting, and somehow that was all right. So then if that's all right, why isn't this all right too? Trump is just a more vile version of a lot of things we've seen in the recent past. So
it's hard to understand.
Where do you find that bright line, you know, that we need?
Yeah, truth is so elusive, isn't it? It's like we have more access to information, and yet the populace doesn't seem to be reading as much or be the ability to critically think is being lost. And I just listened to Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Uh-huh.
Has anybody ever read this book, Amusing Ourselves to Death? Not one person. Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death. Everybody just weekend reading, Audible. It's amazing. It just talks about how the television has, you know, changed politics forever. And then people used to get read newspapers, and the percentage of people in New England who were reading newspapers at one point was so high. The literacy rate and the knowledge of politics and knowledge of what was going on in the world was just off the charts compared to today.
I don't know. I guess I'm still an optimist. I'm still an internet zealot, and I still believe that like the level of like mental sophistication required to use Snapchat is actually higher than is required to like read a newspaper or watch TV passively. Like there's a kind of like active mental modeling of like the modern, more complex tools. So I have this like totally unfounded, unverified, but nonetheless optimistic belief that we're somehow getting smarter and that we're like going to figure these things out.
I'm optimistic as well. I think that net, technology and the people who are building it have very good intention, and it's trending in the right place. And the interdependencies that are created when the world becomes network work against things like dictators and wars and miscommunications. I mean, it's very hard right now for the United States and Russia and China, for anybody to be at war. It's very hard. I mean, even when you look at what happened with this information being leaked now between connections between Saudi Arabia and 9/11 and all this stuff, it's very hard for us to go to war, globally. We have to kind of work these things out in nuclear way.
I buy into Steven Pinker's thesis. I don't know if you saw the book.
Oh, it's a great book. I've read it,
It's a great book.
Our Better Angels.
Our Better Angels, right.
Yeah.
And just the idea that the world is more peaceful now than it's ever been and things are in general better than they've ever been, I think is basically right. But ironically, the very thing that makes it possible for us to know that has also given birth to social media and news and all these clickbait incentives to like try to make things look as bad as possible. So like at the same time that things are actually getting better, we consume a media environment that's very negativity biased. So we'll see. That's been an interesting trend to watch that play out.
Yeah, the chances of having a violent death, being murdered, being killed, being raped is plummeted. But we barrage ourselves with news items of the most horrible thing of the day.
Oh, yeah. If you ask people to rate their probability of various violent things happening compared to the past, people think it's worse now than it was before in a lot of places. So, we have some work to do to become more enlightened. But I just feel like we have the tools to do it. So now we have to figure out the political will, and we have to figure out, like, there's some hard problems to be solved, but we have the raw materials required to clothe, feed, and educate every person on this earth. And we didn't have that. Like, that wasn't true 100 years ago. So shame on us if we don't take advantage of that opportunity. But also, like, how can we be upset? That's so incredible.
Well, and how fitting we're here at Microsoft with Bill Gates has done more post his Microsoft achievements now
Incredible.
In terms of what he's done in infant mortality and diseases and poverty.
Yeah.
The number of people living in, true poverty, it's plummeting, and it will be zero at the end of our lifetimes.
I hope so.
According to the statistics, it's going to go to zero. This I'm talking about the worst level of poverty. And it's been cut in half, I think, in the last 5 years.
That's right.
And a lot of it's with the Gates Foundation. So, listen, I could talk to you for hours. This is the talk we usually have after we have this talk.
Yeah, right.
We delve into the politics and the world. But it is all so related.
It is.
And this has been a wonderful 75 minutes. We went a little bit over.
Uh-oh.
Let me hear it for Eric Ries. I mean, just such a great conversation. Very, very well done. Eric has agreed, along with the Microsoft free hosting for life, Eric has agreed to become an advisor to each of your companies. And he's going to be here till 2 a.m. Signing books and shaking your hand. But do buy the book. I really recommend you all just buy a couple of copies of Lean Startup. Keep it on your desk. Hand it out to your employees and team members as they come and join your company. It's really the most important book, I think, for people to read when they're starting a company. And it's just great to have you as a guest for the third time on This Week in Startups. You're now, I think, in the top two or three people in terms of number of times on the show. So
I'm really honored. That's
it's becoming like that's a Saturday really cool. Night Live.
Yeah. Well,
it's like a Saturday Night Live thing. You're becoming like Alec Baldwin or Steve Martin in terms of the number of...
I think that's a compliment.
It is.
No, thank you. I always have a great time, and thanks for being such an incredible audience. So
okay.
Appreciate it.
Cheers.